And we have to come now to our fifth and last great Buddhist of the 20th century, Edward Conze. Eberhard Julius Diedrich Conze was born in London, in 1904, of mixed German, French and Dutch ancestry. His father belonged to the landed aristocracy, and his mother to what he himself would have called the plutocracy. His background was Protestant, though his mother became a Roman Catholic in later life. Incidentally, he seems to have had a rather bad relationship with his mother, like Madame David Neil, though obviously for rather different reasons. He was born in England because his father happened at that time to be German vice consul. And of course his mother was there also in England. And he was educated at various German universities. He had a gift for learning languages, he tells us. And by the time he was 24, he knew 14 languages, including Sanskrit. He came into contact with theosophy and astrology. And in fact, he was a keen astrologer all his life, not only believing in it, but practicing it and casting the horoscopes of his friends. He wrote a very big book called The Principle of Contradiction. This was when he was still a young man. And he tells us that his mother remarked that she was not surprised that he had written such a book, since he himself was a bundle of contradictions. The late 20s and early 30s were the time of the rise of Nazism in Germany. And the youthful Conze was very strongly opposed to the Nazi ideology. So strongly opposed, in fact, that he went to what some people would consider the opposite extreme. He became a communist and he joined the Communist Party. Not only that, he made a serious study of Marxist thought. He hasn't given too many details, but it seems that for a while he was the leader of the communist movement in Bonn. Eventually, like so many others at the time and later, he became disillusioned with communism. But meanwhile, for the remainder of his time in Germany, he actively opposed not only Nazism, but the Nazis. And there was a time when his life was in serious danger. In 1933, he came to England. He'd taken the precaution of renewing his British nationality earlier, because after all, he'd been born in England, and he arrived in England when he was 29, virtually without money and without possessions, and he supported himself by teaching German and taking evening classes. And he became a member of the Labour Party. And he became a close friend of Ellen Wilkinson. Now, I don't know any of you have heard of Ellen Wilkinson. In her day, she was a very famous Labourite. She became a minister in the post-war Labour government. But he got to know her very well. And through her, he met so many other prominent figures in the Labour movement. He wasn't very impressed by the Labour Party intellectuals. After all, he'd been to a whole series of German universities. And he was even less impressed by the trade union leaders whom he met. He also had contact with the India League. This was in the late 20s, early 30s. He met Pandit Nehru and he met Krishna Menon. He wasn't very impressed by them either. So, as you can imagine, he was a rather critical sort of person. And for some years, he was very active in the Labour come socialist movement in Britain. He wrote lots of books and pamphlets and he went about lecturing, but eventually he became quite disillusioned with politics per se. And at the age of 35, halfway through life, he found himself in a state of intellectual turmoil and even collapse. And his marriage, he had got married some years earlier, his marriage also by that time had failed. And in his memoirs, he he wrote a little bit about his marriage and about women in general, and he wrote that I'm one of those unfortunate people who can neither live with women or without them. But anyway, help was at hand. He discovered Buddhism. Or rather, he rediscovered it. He came in contact with the writings of D.T. Suzuki. And they were literally his salvation. That wasn't his very first contact, but it was the first significant contact. He tells us that at the age of 13, he'd read Gleanings in Buddha Fields by Lafcadio Hearn, which some of you may know. I myself read it when I was in my teens. And at the heading, at the beginning of each chapter in this book, Gleanings in Buddha Fields, there were quotations from the Diamond Sutra. So this was quite significant in view of certain later developments in his life. So after this rediscovery of Buddhism, there was no turning back. He devoted the rest of his life to Buddhism. And in particular, he devoted the rest of his life to translating the Prajnaparamita, or Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, the fundamental scriptures, you may say, of the whole Mahayana Buddhist movement. But he wasn't just a scholar in the academic sense. During the war, the Second War that is, he lived in a caravan in the New Forest on his own. And he devoted himself to meditation. He practiced meditation, following mainly the instructions given by Buddha Gosha in the Visuddhimagga, very, very seriously, and achieved a certain amount of meditative experience. After the war, he moved to Oxford. He remarried. In 1951, he brought out Buddhism, Its Essence and Development, a very successful book which is still in print. But his real achievement in the course of the next 20-odd years was his translation of the Prajnaparamita, or Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. There are altogether more than 30 of these important sutras, large and small. The three most important are the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines, as we say, then the Diamond, or rather Diamond Cutter Sutra, rather shorter, and then the Heart Sutra, the heart of the Perfection of Wisdom, which is very short indeed. And it was in connection with his translations of the Prajnaparamita Sutras that I myself came in contact with Dr. Konze. I started publishing his select sayings from the Perfection of Wisdom in Stepping Stones in, I think it was 1951. In that connection we corresponded, and after I came to England in 64, we met a number of times, and we found we agreed about quite a lot of things. He happened to have reviewed my survey of Buddhism in very favourable terms, which always helps. Dr. Konze was one of our great Buddhist translations. He can be compared with Kumarajiva and Yuen San. In the 60s and 70s, he visited the United States and taught at several universities there. But he did not get on very well in the United States. Well, he got on very well with the students, but he didn't get on very well with the university authorities and with some of his colleagues, because he was a very outspoken person. And that was the time, of course, of the United States' involvement in Vietnam, and Dr. Konze was very critical of that involvement of theirs. And in that connection, of course, his own previous association with communism didn't do him any good, and he eventually had to leave the States. He died in 1979, and he was quite a complex figure. It's not easy to assess his overall significance. In many ways, he was a middle European intellectual. Could even say he was an intellectual of the intellectuals. But he wasn't at all representative, because he was very critical of many trends in modern thought. He was a self-confessed elitist. He was rather proud of being an elitist. Not the sort of thing that people tend to be proud of these days. He didn't look with any great approval on either democracy or feminism. So you can guess that he wasn't very politically correct, as we say nowadays. The great divide in his life, of course, was when he abandoned communism and politics for Buddhism. So in this way, he's representative of a whole pre-war generation that became disillusioned with Marxism in many parts of the West, especially disillusioned with communism and Marxism in their Russian Soviet form. Dr. Konze himself, by the way, did visit the Soviet Union briefly in 1960 and was not at all impressed by what he saw. But unlike many of that generation who took to communism and Marxism, he was not only became disillusioned with it for various reasons, but instead devoted himself to Buddhism. He placed all his scholarly talents at the service of the Dharma. It's especially significant, I think, that he tried to practice Buddhism, especially meditation, not just to study it. This was very unusual at the time. We're talking of the 40s and 50s. It was considered even eccentric then. Scholars were not supposed to have any personal involvement in their subject. They were supposed to be objective. I had an experience of my own in this connection as late as the 70s. There was a publisher on the continent, I won't mention which country, who wanted to bring out a translation, or it was proposed by their reader, I think, that they should bring out a translation of my Three Jewels, one of my books on Buddhism. But the publishers eventually decided against it because they said, well, the Three Jewels was written by Sangharakshita, and Sangharakshita is a Buddhist, and he can't be objective about Buddhism. So they didn't publish it. I afterwards heard that they published a translation of one of Alan Watts' books. Perhaps they didn't consider him a Buddhist. Well, he's not one of my great Buddhists of the 20th century, is he? So Konze was the forerunner of a whole new breed of Western scholars in Buddhism. Scholars, but also Buddhists. Buddhists, but also scholars.